Hey, it's Max. Before we get started, I wanted to let you know something, which is that it's time. It is time to turn your great idea into a reality with Squarespace. Squarespace makes it easier than ever to launch your passion project, whether you're showcasing your writing, maybe it's like a portfolio site for your work, or you're selling products, any kind of website that you've been kicking around wanting to start. Squarespace is the easiest way, the best way to get it off the ground. They've got beautiful templates and the ability to customize just about anything, so you can make a gorgeous website all by yourself without knowing a lick of code. If you do get stuck, you won't, but if you do, Squarespace has 24/7 award-winning customer support there to help you along the way. Head to squarespace.com/longform for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code LONGFORM to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Thanks, Squarespace. One more thing you should do is pick up The Mastermind. It's the new book by my co-host, Evan Ratliff. It's gotten all kinds of insanely rave reviews. The book is fantastic. I talked to Evan about it on the show a few weeks ago. If you have not yet picked up your copy of The Mastermind, go ahead and do that. Here's the program. Hello, welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, great to see you.
Hey, nice to see you again.
And who'd you interview, Max?
I interviewed Sloane Crosley, essayist. She got a new book out. It's called Look Alive Out There. It's a collection of essays. It's her second or third. She's got a lot of essays out in the world.
Second or third essay collection.
That's right. Yes. This is her second essay ever. She's coming on the show. We're going to spend half the time on the first essay and half the time on the second essay. No, I was really excited to talk to her, in part because before she was a published author, she worked for published authors. She was like a book publicist. I feel like we haven't had someone who's been on both sides of those that line. So we talked about that.
If you are blurring the line between writing, promotion, publicity, marketing, you can combine all of those talents into an email newsletter that can bring you new business, new contacts, and new fun, all with MailChimp. They make it easy. You don't even have to start paying until you hit a certain number of subscribers. So there's really nothing stopping you from getting that together today, thanks to MailChimp.
And who doesn't want a little new fun?
Yeah.
New fun.
Sign up now.
And now here's Max with Sloane Crosley.
Well, hey, Sloane.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming.
I'm very excited to be here, legitimately.
I am also legitimately excited to have you here. I saw you give a talk or like a do a reading or I don't remember what it
build
was.
Build a diorama.
Build a diorama. I saw you build a diorama on stage years ago. I think like even like right when we started the podcast, which is many years ago now. And I had this thought that was like, man, what a thing if the podcast could ever get to a place where someone like that would come on.
Oh, wow. I did not see that story going to this incredibly flattering lily pad.
That is where it went. Well, the diorama was incredible.
The diorama. I'd build a diorama on stage, mix it up. I just came off book tour. It might be a new thing to do.
Change it up.
Yeah.
So anyway, I feel in my version of events, this is like a long time coming, so I'm very happy you're here.
This is a thrill.
I have so many things I want to talk to you about. Most of them, I feel like, should be about writing because that's what the show is about. But this is a rare opportunity on the Long Form Podcast to talk to someone who understands book publicity.
Yes.
Because book publicity is like a bit of a mysterious art, I would say, on the program.
I would agree with you. On the program.
Well, we talk to people a lot who have books coming out.
Right.
And there's a lot of like existential fear about whether or not your book is going to work. And then there are these people, the publicists, who seems as though their job is to make the book work.
Yeah.
But no one knows how
to like hold your ego and the fate of your career in this sort of light.
Yeah. They're
kind
just
of grasp.
They're like a presence in these conversations, but we never had one here. And seeing as how you started there,
I did.
I want to talk to you about it for a second.
Oh, good. I mean, and quite proudly, I started there. I really loved it.
How did you get into it?
Well, my first job out of college was for a literary agent, and Actually, let me back it up a bit. All my internships were for magazines. You know, when I was a baby, I interned for like the New Yorker, a magazine called Post, which everyone always thinks is the New York Post, but it's in fact a trade magazine about post-production and special effects.
Oh, I thought it was going to be like a mail-carrying trade publication. I get really excited.
I wish. but I did it at the same time that I interned, and this is very much dating myself, but it is the summer it folded, but I interned for Mirabella at the same time, so okay. It was very... different crowd, as you might imagine, writing about the special effects for the new Star Wars movie and Mirabella. Yeah. But I like the speed of those magazines, but I found them, and now that I think they've both gone the way of the dodo, I can say a little vacuous. And so I wanted something a little more heady, and I'd always written, you know, and I was sort of fancying myself a secret writer, and I was a big reader and an English major and all those things that are generally requisite.
What does secret writer mean?
Secret writer means writing short stories, not really showing them to anybody. I guess that's what secret writer means.
Okay.
But I had, I had built up this sort of resume for magazines, but then my first job was in books. And that was a little too slow, I think, for me as a literary agent. And so I found myself this sort of perfect sweet spot for a really long time. I mean, I stayed in book publicity for like 10 years. That was sort of the most social high-speed end of this very slow, awkward machine that is book publishing. And it was sort of outward-facing. So I was constantly dealing with the media and feeling, you know, that sort of Lorax-y kind of role for the books. And that's how I got into it.
When did you become not a secret writer? Like, when did you tell people that you were also one? And how did that work with the job you were doing?
You know, it's funny because I think I might have misspoken a little bit when I said secret because it sounds like this intentional masking. It was more just like, demoted.
Like unsuccessful.
Just unsuccessful. Exactly. There's so much in life that everybody thinks is, you know, they want to know your trajectory. That's why people do shows like this. And you feel like half a fraud answering the question because you're like, well, I would definitely not do what I did. But have at it if you'd like to, you know, work in book publicity on the off chance that one day you publish a book. It's not a recommended route. But
it worked.
Well, it worked, but it worked the way having a day job while you're trying to do something creative works, where you're not consistently stressed about money and health insurance. So it's very unglamorous in the way it worked. It's not like Toni Morrison turned around one day and said, you know, this press release, there's something to it. No one said this to me.
No, so, that never happened.
No.
But did it make you a better writer? Like being around that?
It replaced, I think, something. And, you know, I did not think I was going to trash my parents this early into the episode. But they were very supportive of me being creative and supportive of my writing. Same thing with my sister, and they're creative people themselves. But it wasn't necessarily a viable vocation. You know, they didn't necessarily send me to school for it. Mm-hmm. But I've heard tell of other authors, like Ann Patchett talks about growing up in her house. You know, her mother's a writer, and a writer was a perfectly viable profession. And that's the same thing with like all the Minot kids. And, you know, I imagine like Chip McGrath, Ben McGrath, like they're all these sort of families that it's a natural profession. And I think that working in book publicity kind of gave me a late stage version of that because every book I saw was published. I mean, I'm not working in editorial where you're, you know, still weeding out what's possible and you're still dealing with submissions. Everything I read was on its way to be bound.
Right.
So it's not that you think you can write as well as these people. It just, it starts to occur to you that what you're doing can eventually go to this place.
So you're going through that process and then like, I mean, just help me understand a little bit because I think like part of why I was interested in it is that it feels like a little cinematic to me, you know, it's like secret struggling writer on the one hand and then dealing with like America's foremost authors on the other. And then at some point these things like converge and I'm just interested in that experience for you.
Yeah, that, I mean...
You can also just be like, that is very corny.
No, it's not corny. But the problem is that it's such a, it's like an overlaid narrative on my life that it's like sometimes hard to tell the difference between what happened and what people are so used to this sort of local girl makes good idea of me.
Yeah, well, like tell me that that
Yeah, basically,
that was bullshit.
Well, yeah. No, it's not bullshit. It's just that it's, It's like when you look at somebody and you say, oh, you know, you got a haircut. And they're like, well, yeah, I guess a while ago. But to you, it looks dramatic. To me, I've been cutting my hair for years. But I wrote book and music reviews for Black Book and all these different tiny publications. Some of them, I think, are uncredited. I don't even know if they have my name on them. Or like guidebooks and stuff like that. And then the sort of story, or like the sort of watered down lore in a teapot, is that I was moving apartments in New York. I was 24, 25, and I locked myself out of the first apartment while moving. I mean, moving is already very stressful, and I did that thing where you shut the door and you go to touch the doorknob and you just know with every fiber in your being that it's not going to turn, you know. And so I had to pay a locksmith an exorbitant fee and then move just a few blocks north. Went to throw out the first cardboard box and shut the door and realized that, lo and behold, I had done it again, which is not really giving me not a lot of points in my favor here in terms of common sense. But then I called the same locksmith, and he came, and I had a doormat at the time that said Deja Vu frontwards and backwards. And he pointed with his pen, and he said, that's a funny doormat. And it was this thing where I just wrote it up as sort of an essay with a little bit of a Law and Order play-by-play overlay of the timestamps. I sent it to some friends, including Ed Park, who had worked at the Village Voice. And he said, you know, if you clean this up and you spell check it, see what that might be like, I'll publish it. And I started writing for The Voice. And I'm lucky in the fact that I worked for a department of people that were incredibly supportive at Vintage. And I'm not the only one. This is the other really weird thing, actually, is that, you know, when we talk about secret authorship, it's a lot of times it's the editorial department that has some sort of manuscript underneath the desk. But that department at Vintage, within a, I think, 3-year span, was me, a fellow named Ethan Rutherford, who wrote several books of short stories, as well as has been in Best American, Paul Yoon, same thing, Hanya Yanagihara, who wrote A Little Life, a guy named Martin Wilson, who wrote a YA book. This is a seven-person department. If you weren't a writer, I always think about this on a side note about like the three people in that infamous class at Bennington that had Bret Easton Ellis and Lethem and Donna Tartt, and like I always imagine some mediocre kid rolling out of bed being like, why do I suck?
Yeah, just like that writing workshop class is exactly. Just absolutely,
it's just
brutal.
Ridiculous. It sounds awful. But so yeah, it was like pretty common. And so I had support internally as long as I was still, you know, being a functional advocate for the authors, and right. I was. And
were
then
you good
I
at
started
it?
At publicity?
Yeah.
I was really good at it. Yeah. I really loved it. I loved it so much. And it's weird because it's a thing that no one loves. Because it's thankless.
What does being good at it look like?
Being good at it is, I would say, 70% creativity and 30% hyper-organization. And I wasn't great at that 30% part, but I was really good at the 70% part. I'd get really excited about the books.
Wait, sorry, I didn't totally. Like, I assume that all book publicists are excited about the books. I mean, is that like saying like everyone who works in construction is like excited about buildings?
Yeah, there's no Santa. Also, we pay for front of the store placement. That was like a no Santa thing for me when I found out that that book publishing houses bought placement for their books in the front of bookstores.
Yeah.
So,
you were just saying like I got excited, but I assume some people do. I just want to know literally like how do you be good at that?
I mean, there's a certain amount of alchemy to it that's hard to define, where things just have to go right, and it's really hard to turn them around if they go wrong. And some of that just has to do with what the public wants in the book.
I think that's like, if I'm being a little bit more honest about what I'm asking, my sense is that this stuff is like a little bit of a crapshoot.
Yeah, but I think that you know, or at least I know as an author, so now I've published 4 books. 5, if you count one I wrote under a pseudonym, but
wait, what was that? I didn't find that one. I read all the rest of them.
It's fine. But the thing is, what's funny is so I've now published 4 books, and I've been on 8 book tours total, and you can tell when someone's trying hard and really doing the best possible job that they can and wants to work with you and is excited with you, and then if things don't happen, they don't happen, and it's okay, you know. I think what makes it good is just we're living in a landscape that has a narrowing amount of media and like less and less media options. And so trying to figure out how to get a book attention is increasingly difficult and requires more creativity. That's all.
Like in the pitch?
Sure, but no one reads the pitch letter. I think it's who you talk to. I think it's if I were to like really get down to it,
damn,
I think it's I just don't know if it would work. So I quit 10 years ago. So yeah. I don't know if this is really accurate. So like my recommendation would be to look at the masthead of a magazine and try to contact people who aren't just the book's editor. I think it's in how you pitch people. Know the names of the sections. You know, don't just say this would be perfect for Vogue, but, you know,
yeah,
because it means nothing. and I think it's just that sort of passion for figuring out where that book could go. It's like a video game if you do it well and you just try to rack up different hits for this book.
Yeah. I mean, part of the reason I'm asking about this, too, is on the one hand, book publishing, like I have enough friends that have gone through it now that like it seems so impossible to predict what's going to work outside mm-hmm. of the like incredibly obvious things that have to work. So like how the levers get pulled, I don't understand very well.
Well, we have such an allergy as just a culture to things that are being shoved down our throat, which it didn't actually used to be quite so bad. Like, you know, you could have a book be the lead title of a publishing house that's on the cover of a catalog and, you know, those sort of markers of importance, the first printing, you know, the advance, all that stuff, I think used to mean more. And now everyone's just so dubious of being spoon-fed anything. That you can even see it in, you know, what the Times chooses to cover. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there are some daily reviewers and even some reviewers within the TBR who probably get off a little on, you know, putting a publication from Grey Wolf or Tin House or some of these sort of venerable but much smaller presses in their pages over the big giant title from Simon & Schuster.
Hey, it's Max. I'm going to put Sloan on hold for just a second, let you know about some people that are sponsoring the show this week, making it possible for us to do the long-form podcast. First up is the Great Courses Plus. And for so many of us, school was about learning practical, marketable skills. But deep down, you still love learning. You still love exploring fascinating stories, painting, playing music, indulging your brain without it being tied to money or responsibility. The Great Courses Plus is an app that's just there to indulge that specific kind of curiosity, which maybe, I don't know, maybe you've lost it a little bit. You can find it again with the Great Courses Plus. It's a service that offers a huge library of audio and visual courses on just about any topic you can imagine, all delivered by experts who present the material in a way that's fun and fascinating. Everything from Egyptian hieroglyphics to human personality, screenwriting, baking, really, it's like the entire gamut. And you can listen to it. You don't have to watch. You can listen on your own time. You can learn on any device completely on your own schedule. And I have found that it's really nice to listen to the lectures. Sometimes I listen to them on my way home. They've got some ones about parenting, like how to help your kid not be a total psychopath. That's not the name of the course, but that's how I interpret it. And I listen to it on my way home before I see the kid. And then I've got some tools to help him not be a psychopath. There's all kinds of things on the Great Courses Plus. You will learn and you won't feel like there's homework or it's another thing on your to-do list. It's all about just indulging your brain. Go indulge your brain. Make the Great Courses Plus your go-to for lifelong learning. For a limited time, they're offering our listeners a full free month of unlimited access to their entire library. But to get that special offer, you got to sign up using our special URL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/longform. Again, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/longform. Thanks to them for sponsoring the show. And thanks also to our friends at Squarespace. Squarespace makes it easier than ever to launch your passion project. Maybe you go learn something on the Great Courses and then you want to share what you've learned, build a website, do it with Squarespace. It's also great if you're starting a new business, you need to showcase your work, publish content, sell products. Really, they have templates and sites for any need that you might have. It's the tool for you. And these templates they got, they're gorgeous. Created by world-class designers, the ability to customize just about anything with a few clicks. You can really make a beautiful website all by yourself and you don't need to know any code at all. They've got powerful e-commerce functionality. You can sell anything, analytics, you know who's coming. It's all optimized for mobile right out of the box. There's nothing to patch or upgrade ever, really. If you want a website, but you don't know how to code, Squarespace is your answer. They got 24/7 award-winning customer support. They empower millions of people, from designers to lawyers, artists to gamers, even restaurants and gyms, to turn great ideas into something real. Now it's your turn. Head to squarespace.com/longform for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code longform to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Again, that's squarespace.com/longform, offer code longform. Thanks to them for sponsoring the show. Let's get back to Sloan. I mean, I think part of it also is... We get pitched all the time.
I'm sure.
And I'd say like 90-something% of the pitches are like basically saying, it would be really good for me if you did this.
Which
does not seem like an effective strategy to me. Like, there's like a...
How do they say that?
It's the version of what you're saying, right? It's just like, it's some sort of like form thing that's obviously been sent to a lot of places. Mm-hmm. It has like no... context at all for the kinds of things that like I like to talk about. And it's basically like, here's why this would be great for me if you were to do this. Like, I'm shilling this book. Be great if I get some press for this book.
I think it's just that it takes the amount of time it takes to personalize all those letters and do all those things. It really will keep you at the office until 10:30 or 11 at night, and then you get back in at 9. It really is crazy. I mean, I remember once doing a mailing for Black Lizard, which is an imprint within Vintage, or was, that did a lot of crime, and there was an anthology of like the best of like these sort of noir stories from the 40s and 50s, and I wrapped all these galleys in black wrapping paper because I thought that would be a good idea. And like once I commit to it, I just sort of had to do them all. Even though I realize in retrospect, there's no way anyone would know that anyone else's galleys were wrapped, but I stayed forever getting all these paper cuts, you know, wrapping things in black wrapping paper just to try to get people's attention. But I'm also committed like that. Like I'll, like every time I sign a copy of I Was Told There'd Be Cake, I draw cake in it, and there's not a copy that doesn't have that.
Really?
And it takes forever.
Did that like just come to you, or is that a plan?
No, it just came to me the first time I did it, and then I just kept doing it. I don't know why. No one's gonna I mean, now that I've said it out loud, it's monitorable.
Yeah, now you really have to do
right.
it. Right. Yeah. Or you can just do like one that doesn't have it, and then that's like
or a stamp. Murakami does this thing where he does a stamp, he does a Japanese character. He's a like build a diorama on stage kind of guy, you know.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
We should have him on the show sometime.
Yeah.
Once you see someone build a diorama. All right. I don't want to get too much into the weeds of this stuff. I just I was hoping
I wish I remembered more to give you the secret sauce. And I honestly, because if I remembered more, I would tell my own current publicist to do it.
Well, I guess that's my last question on this publicist section of things, which is like now being in the other seat, is it like is it a weird experience? Or are you kind of like I'll just drive the fucking car?
It's different because it's this sort of combination where you know what's possible. You know, none of my publicists will ever hear the words, you know, have you sent it to the Today Show? What about Terry Gross?
Right.
To which every publicist in the world should have sort of carte blanche to just be like, what about her, and flick you in the head. But so I'm not going to ask something idiotic like that, but I will know, you know, there's a standard author form where, you know, one of the questions is, do you have any contacts in the media? You know, do you have any bookseller contacts? And yeah, of course I'm going to have, you know, a stapled sheet that says C subsection.
Right.
A, but it doesn't mean that they're going to cover my book. And in fact, I would say that at first it was the local girl makes good thing. And it was kind of a neat story that I had come from inside the house, as it were. But then it sort of started to frankly work against me a little bit because nobody wants to look like they're covering their friends. Mm-hmm. And because I was friendly for a living with every publication in America, it can actually be a real problem.
Has that like come out the other side now? Are you like...
I think maybe the next book it'll come out the other side. It takes a while.
This one still felt like you were in it a little bit?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, it's also like there's less and less review coverage, but it's more interviews and stuff like that. But it's also It's not a, I don't wake up in the middle of the night punching my fist in the air over this thinking, you know, like, damn you, daily TBR, where are you? But I clock it.
What do you wake up in the middle of the night, shake your fist about?
Oh, maybe like I wish, maybe Robert De Niro and Albert Brooks in their careers. I want the former to do more drama again and the latter to do more comedy.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I get upset about.
It's a very solid and specific answer.
I know. That's like the answer of someone who does not have children, by the way. That's the answer of somebody who doesn't wake up being like, my kid's going to get kidnapped or run over.
I will say there's a degree of sort of mental space in that answer, which I find very appealing and foreign.
And foreign, right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's the anxiety everyone has. I mean, at this point, it's also the anxiety of just being in the delightful position of knowing people are going to pay attention to you, and then the second realization of knowing that you therefore have to, that people are going to pay attention to you.
Yeah.
And so the next thing you do should be good.
Well, let's talk about the things that you do.
Okay.
Let's talk about...
that I've done in the past 10 years.
Yeah, let's talk about recent times.
Great.
I'm trying to figure out where to start. Maybe we should start at the end a little bit.
Okay.
I just finished the new one, the new collection.
Look Alive Out There.
Yeah, Look Alive. The title of the book is Look Alive Out There. And I wondered what, if anything, felt different to you about this last collection compared to the first two.
In the writing of it?
Yeah, or like what you were trying to do. Or what you were interested in.
I think that it feels like a balance to me between the first and the second a little bit. Like a third bear, I guess. or mixtape or something like that. And now I'm just like reaching for analogies. But in the fact that it's the same kind of tone, I think, that I've always had. A little less concerned with like jokes per square inch, which actually I think makes it funnier. And then just as I go on, I like to take sort of objectively unfunny things and try to make them funny. So like the first book, you know, I make a cookie for my first boss in the shape of her head, and someone like poops on my floor. And these things are funny things. And then the second one, though, still has some of that. Maybe a hair less scatological. But, you know, I also see a baby bear get hit by a truck in Alaska, which is not funny in itself, but everyone's reaction to it was kind of funny, you know. And so you take these, you know, increasingly sort of either meatier or darker things or just sort of bigger things. There's one that was about my teenage neighbors. And maybe if like earlier, it would have possibly just been a noise complaint essay. And now it's really about aging and youth and how I kept waiting for them to shut up by growing up. And, you know, they were never going to catch up with me and I couldn't wait for them because of time and space. And it's really about that, or about, you know, fertility and the pressure to freeze your eggs or the pressure to have children, and you know, that's in there too. Or, you know, the Gossip Girl essay is really about identity. So things become sort of larger but with the same tone. And I think, I mean, I like this one, but don't, I mean, I often like what I've done the most recently the best. I think that's sort of human. You know, I mean, there are some greatest hits from the past where I think, you know what, I really knocked that one out of the park, but they're few and far between. It's really what I've done most recently.
Do you feel like super in touch with that stuff? Like, do you go back and read it?
No, I don't.
It seems like a terrifying exercise.
Well, also, it's sort of like, just to add to, I'll give you some terrifying imagery to go with the exercise. It would be like shoving yourself back into the womb, you know? I mean, you already came out, and it would almost be like, or more, in a more polite image, sort of like an Uncanny Valley thing where it sort of looks like you, and it's sort of you, but it's you from, I mean, I was told there'd be cake. It took a while because there were some publishing snafus. So I wrote it when I was 27.
There were publishing snafus?
There were some snafus.
Really?
Yeah.
Publicist?
No, it was, I mean, I think now it can be told.
Yeah, tell
it.
Do
you want me to?
Yeah. It's,
okay. So I had an editor at HarperCollins who was going to publish the first book. And that came about after I had had pieces that were in the Village Voice that had been linked to on Gawker that had gone slightly viral or you know, wouldn't be considered viral now.
Very, they're like quaint viral.
Yeah, like a contained, adorable little rash, you know. And so I put together this book proposal and they bought it and I was thrilled because I had a novel under the table, but I thought, you know, meanwhile, this is great. And I don't mean to make it sound like the Wild Wild West for essays, but it wasn't like the common practice of publishing as it is now, personal essays specifically, and specifically by women. It was really dominated by David Rykoff, David Sedaris, Bill Bryson, people like that. Hodgman, Klosterman, I'm just going to keep naming them, but you get the idea. But what happened was, is they, I think I was working, or I wanted to work much more in the vein of Sedaris and Joseph Mitchell and Dorothy Parker, and these people are my heroes. And they wanted to put me in, they were revamping Atria, which I think is still a romance imprint of HarperCollins.
Okay.
I don't know what happened with it, but they wanted to put me in a different imprint, which it's weird because contracts, that generally does not happen in book publishing.
Yeah.
But it so thoroughly does not happen that contracts usually don't make allowances for it. They can do that. And all of a sudden I'm getting all these notes saying maybe you could do a box of tips at the tail end of all your essays saying, you know, should you find yourself in this situation, this is what you should do.
You're like, can you just like romance it up?
Romance it up. And I just got scared at first that the galleys were going to have, you know, a glitter martini glass with like a shoe in lieu of an olive kind of thing.
It just says like party girl and
right, exactly, exactly.
There's literally a martini glass in my
That's his party girl?
That's his party girl. I'll show it to you after.
Well, yeah. But you know, there's a way to do that, ironically.
This is ironic. Yeah,
way to do that.
It's not the cover of
a
book.
Yeah, or there's a way, like there's like a Marilyn Minter kind of way to do that. And then there's the way that I was really scared about, which is sort of cartoonish. And then yeah. I got a next level fear, which is that they weren't going to make galleys at all. That it was just going to be this sort of straight to DVD publication. And then the edits I got from my editor, who no longer works at that company. You know, you want to connect with somebody when you write these personal essays, and that's the point of them. But you also don't want their exact story back when you need edits. So, you know, okay, well, when this happened to me. And it got pretty bad. And I realized how bad it was getting. This is during, like, the Judith Regan, OJ sort of debacle. And I realized that I needed to pull the book. And so...
Wow.
I know. And so I met with Sean McDonald, who's been my editor and is now at FSG, but he was at Riverhead at the time. And I talked to him about it. And I had talked to other people about it, too. And he said, you know, I can't even look at a manuscript that's under contract with someone else. That's crazy. You're just going to have to pull it. That's when he really said that. And I remember walking from Old Town Bar home to the Upper West Side. And like by the time I got home, I thought, would I rather have it in a drawer and tell all my friends and family that I don't have this book coming out? And the answer was yes. And so I pulled it, and then HarperCollins sued me.
What was the conversation like when you pulled it?
I'm telling you this story. It's quite elaborate, but it just occurred to me that I've never really told this story before.
What was the conversation like when you pulled it? Like, do you remember how that felt?
To pull it? Scary, because I didn't know if anyone was going to publish it. It was very scary.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd gotten so little money for it. So therefore, to have to give money back on top of that money kept me in ramen noodles for a while. And then, yeah, but Riverhead bought it.
Wait, but then they sued you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm kind of glossing over that part. But then they, yeah, I can't remember the number, but it was a lot. I think, you know, we're dealing with, let's say, an advance that was around... I don't know, $15,000. And I think that they then wanted an additional $8,000 back. I'm trying to remember the details of it. And I think there was a negotiation, but I paid them.
You paid them over the 15 mm-hmm. to get your book back?
Yes.
Because they were going to put glitter on it.
I think it's an ego thing. I think what happened is, you know, I had just gotten a blurb from like Jonathan Lethem. And I think I'm always sort of dubious of when you get to be an author of a certain sort of stage and you start thinking you're not good enough for certain things or you're above certain things and it's not healthy. But I wasn't. I just genuinely thought, like, you're going to be a bad babysitter for my child.
Yeah.
And I gotta go. Otherwise, my child's going to end up smelling like a baby prostitute. So I have to go. You know? And I did. And I...
So I'm so glad you didn't go down the baby prostitute line.
Me too. But what's funny about it is that the narrative, again, is sort of like that you were talking before about this seems like a kind of like lore fairy tale. Like, oh, it's so easy. I worked in book publishing. And I'm like, oh, little do you guys know.
Little do you guys know.
Not easy.
Almost ended up with a baby prostitute.
Yes. And had to pay a bunch of money to get,
wow,
to get out of
intense.
The brothel.
Wow, that's intense. Yeah. You have never told that before?
I don't think so. I remember being so angry because it was during the OJ scandal and the, you know, the If I Did It book, that I just kept thinking, does your legal department not have bigger fish to fry than me? But I think it's, you know, at the same time, you know, it's not about HarperCollins as a house. It's packed with great editors. And what's worse and what made the whole thing more heartbreaking is that I worked there before I worked for Vintage and after I worked for a literary agent. I worked for HarperCollins, and I felt like a little bit that these were my people. So there was a sense of
yeah, that does
of
really,
hurt.
That yeah. really does like pop the balloon of the fairy tale story.
Yeah,
but it also it sounds like part of it is about having a real sense of who you want to be as a writer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and I'm sure everyone has this, where you know, or not everyone, but I think a lot of people in any kind of creative field, you do something that sort of feels only somewhat out on the limb, you know, it feels like, oh, I don't really care about it that much. And then once it grows, or when other people start caring about it, or when you've invested enough time or creativity in it, you suddenly care a lot. And this is why book contracts exist, on the off chance that you care a lot. you know, at first you're like, oh, it'd be so great if anyone published my book, if my byline appeared anywhere, if anyone made a movie or optioned this or anything, it'd be just a dream. And then you get there and you're like, this could potentially be very bad if I don't protect myself.
Yeah. Did the last book feel at all more personal to you?
The last book definitely. Well, it felt more personal. It felt a little different, too, because there's two sort of more journalistic interview-style essays in the book. One, I interview my uncle. Well, he's my mother's cousin. We call him Uncle Johnny, who was a very big, very prominent, is easier than big, porn star in the 70s. And another one where I interview a guy who is this sort of dark web domain thief.
Slinger.
Yeah, exactly, who took my domain, and I actually, for the New York Times Magazine, went to London to interview him. But beyond that, I think that I've grown to have more faith in the details of my personal life and how they would potentially relate to people. So a good example of that is like the last essay in this book, which is a fairly giant tome about egg freezing, but in a funny way.
Funny version.
Yeah, I think that. And again, it's almost like the doormat story with Deja Vu, frontwards and backwards. There's usually sort of one moment that will often throw things into a sharp relief, even an incredibly long essay like that one.
Yeah.
Where I remember looking at the website for the fertility clinic, and it had a picture of this young couple in a park with a golden retriever. And underneath it said, "Let us help you meet your family goals." And I thought, yeah, I want to give birth to a puppy. Sounds dope. You know?
Got a new goal.
And I kind of knew, you know, and that's yeah. And that's the thing. So I think they're both more personal and a little more embracing of, honestly, being comedic writing. Because I think that that label was really scary to me for a long time because there's so much pressure in it.
Is there a relationship between it being more personal and the jokes per square inch?
Yeah, there's less. But it's a more vulnerable state to understand that you'll get the laughs without the jokes, but just by being your hapless self. You don't actually have to try that hard to make people laugh at you. It comes naturally to them. So that's sort of a fun realization. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, that was how it read to me a little bit. It was just like there were fewer, like, go for it laugh lines, kind
right.
of, and a little bit more of you. But still, I mean, listen, the egg freezing, fucking hilarious.
Thank you. See, I'm glad that even men can relate. Well, because ultimately it's a medical story, and I think medical stuff is really fascinating. Like, ultimately it's a story, you know, like if you told me you broke your arm and told me exactly how and how many places, I like couldn't get enough of it. I find that stuff so interesting.
Why?
I don't know, human fallibility, gross out stuff, having an inner 13-year-old child who's just not inner enough. I don't know. Like, I think maybe it's also the definiteness of a medical problem. You know, I traffic so much in neuroses and you know, sort of vague opinions that become sort of sharpened in my mind, or etiquette. And then there's a couple of essays in this book that, you know, one being one of them and another one about a weird inner ear disease. And I find interactions with doctors to be incredibly funny.
There's a moment in the inner ear one where you're describing the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this moment that basically, like, it's much more eloquently written than this, but basically it's actually like a pretty serious condition. Like, you thought maybe it was something relatively minor, and then it's like actually a pretty serious thing. And the way that you read that response was basically just like, what the fuck? Is essentially how I read it. Again, much more eloquent version of that. But like the moment where you're slightly like disassociated from this very serious diagnosis that you've gotten, and you're in this place where like you're not fully that person who's quite that sick,
right.
But you're not also the person you were when you like walked in the room, you know?
Yes. It's a weird thing to have a strange little disease, and it is a little disease. It's fine. It's called Meniere's. It gives you vertigo. I have to watch my salt intake.
Doesn't sound fun.
It's not fun when it happens, but it's actually not a problem at all when it's not happening. So, you know, what are you going to do? but it's more, you know, that feeling of feeling like I had been sort of fostering a child, you know, before you find out you're diagnosed with something. You just have these symptoms, and that's sort of like the fostering stage. And then you find out, no, you're going to have this for life. And then it feels like a forced adoption, where you're like, this isn't my child. Wait, what? This stays in my house forever and eats all my food? Are you kidding me? I have plans.
It's a terrible deal.
This is a terrible deal. there are some moments of, you know, true shock. But also, it's a funny thing to have vertigo. I mean, vertigo, it's not funny to experience it, but it's an objectively ridiculous thing to have, to spin around and fall down. I mean, maybe in a sort of more like black and white footage of like, you know, Charlie Chaplin way, but that's what's sort of strange about it. I don't know. I guess I just always like, with the essays and with stories like that, the texture of talking to some doctor who is generally humorless, and who I asked at some point, you know, there was construction in his office one point when I was on the phone with my ear, nose, and throat doctor. I said, what is that? And he said, oh, there's construction. I don't even hear it anymore. And I'm like, okay. Like, you're just saying things. You're just feeding me now on purpose. Yeah.
When you're going through your life, how tuned in are you to, like, material? Like, how much are you looking for the next story? And do you think that there's any, to any extent, you are, like, making them happen?
Oof. Probably. I think I should do it more than I do. I mean, the assumption is that I do it all the time, or, you know, from the
outside.
That's
not my, I'm just asking a question.
Oh, okay. You're like, don't put words in my mouth. I think I need to do it more than I do.
You need to create the action more than you do, or be just like,
just
more
be more attuned. Aware. Yeah. You would think that, I mean, it's not like I think about things for a living, you know, but at the same time, I don't fling myself down a dark alley hoping to get an essay out of it. I mean, I do enjoy a dark alley, but I also enjoy complaining every single moment that I'm in that dark alley. I think it would make me, frankly, insufferable to be around if I was just sort of, you know, milking all my friends for odd stories, or, you know, turning them into characters, or insisting that we do ridiculous things together, or even doing ridiculous things by myself. So no, I don't actually seek it out, really. The danger, though, of course, I just realized of that answer is a little bit like, oh, this old thing. But maybe it just does happen to me, or maybe it's just how I see the world. You know, there's an essay in this last book where I had an assignment for a farm magazine. They do this one page spin the growth
Ecuador.
Feature. Yeah, I got Ecuador, and I had no time to plan, and which is the point of the piece. You have like 24 hours.
I love that thing.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, they made me get all these vaccinations beforehand, because they do tell you that. I'm like, where am I going? But I went and I did the piece where I basically like tried to crash the Ecuadorian Oscars, because the woman gave me a pamphlet on the street in Quito. And I wrote, you know, it's 1,000 words, you know, a little ditty about that experience. And then I wrote it almost a chunk of it that night. And then I had time left in Ecuador, in Quito, and I had a friend who said, you should climb Cotopaxi. And I could not be bothered to Google an image of Cotopaxi, which is distinctly covered in ice and very, very tall. I think it's 19,000 feet. And I thought, well, I have legging. I'll go up this. This is fine. And so it ended up being this thing where I threw up on a glacier. It was a mess. And it was that association with that trip. And it's these two very different pieces came out of it. But I didn't go thinking, I thought I was going for the 1,000-word piece and got a 12,000-word piece out of it.
Right. And I mean, when you were like, for example, like puking on the glacier, mm. were you like, oh, this is going to be good?
No.
I think that's part of what I'm asking is like,
right.
There's one thing that's like,
oh, I see.
I'm going to stand up this mountain and then walk over it because it'll be good. Another is like when these funny or somewhat awful things are happening, is there some part of your brain that's like, this is going to work out?
There is like a narrative lizard brain that thinks this will work out, but it depends on what the situation is. For that one, that's a medical thing, and I had a fever of about, 103 and was hallucinating, so I don't think I thought much except for this very sort of plotting, how do I get from point A to point B and get through this, and like, it's so cold and I have to go to the bathroom, how do I negotiate getting down from this, bunk? So that's not, that I wasn't thinking about it. But, the second I walk off that mountain and, the altitude sickness dissipates, I do, the idea of writing about it creeps in. Because, if there's a benefit to this is that there's, no such thing as a totally horrible experience anymore. You either write about it or things sort of pass without incident. I mean, having said that, I did a piece for Vogue a couple months ago where they sent me on a sort of David Foster Wallace Redux cruise. It was a beauty, or it had a beauty element to it. And, that's, again, that's a limited word count that I had, and I managed to fit. I was very impressed with them for letting me put a fair amount of my anger and horrification at this experience, and realizing that as brilliant as David Foster Wallace is, and that piece is an absolute masterpiece. I feel like people copy the nut graph of that all the time. I'm like, oh my gosh, from a sort of thematic or emotional standpoint, you phoned it in, buddy. This is much worse. This is so much worse than the supposedly fun thing I'll never do again. You stayed in your room a lot if you reread that piece.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, this is pretty rough. And so, but that I'm like struggling with because I would love to turn it into the same thing that Quito paradigm of a larger piece, but I'm still so blindingly upset by it that to go back and live in it and go through all my notes and go through all my photos to produce this essay, I'm like not ready yet. I really hated it.
Do you think that you will be?
Yeah, I think eventually. Things do calcify also on their own where, you'll see what you naturally remember, and that's usually trying to tell you something.
How would you explain, if there is one, what the gap is between like Sloan in this book I just read and actual Sloan?
Well, I think the gap is probably pretty apparent from a radio interview in which I'm much less articulate than I am on the page. Well,
aside from like editing.
Right. I think that there's not much except for, I think I'm a little more curmudgeonly in print and a little more, I think I'm nicer in person, probably. I mean, I only say that from sort of empirical evidence of, I just went on book tour for Look Alive Out There and having, librarians or lecture people or bookstore owners, I can tell, and sometimes they've even said as much, that they're a little pleasantly surprised because I think they thought I was going to be more caustic or more New York-y or something like that. And I wouldn't have actually guessed there was a huge difference between me and what's on the page, but that feedback has led me to believe these essays are a touch bitchier.
Okay.
And, yeah.
I'm going to ask you one more personal essay question, then
sure.
I'll let you go in a sec. I wonder what your thoughts are. I feel like there was this moment, like particularly around like Sidaris and then personal essays in general, that's particularly like things about memoir and people going back in time, and Twitter was all like thinking about the personal essay for a moment there, and whether they're real.
Oh, right.
That like whole thing. And I wonder where that sort of falls for you. Like, there's all this stuff in the book, and a lot of your essays are conversations that are years and years old and very specific things. And I wonder what your assumptions are about what assumptions the reader is making.
Oh, wow. Well, what's weird is that I assume that the reader thinks that very detailed dialogue is fabricated for the benefit of the larger truth, right? That's not really true. The dialogue is actually pretty much spot on. Because these are essays, I'm not being assigned them. You know, I mean, if someone told me to write an essay about what happened yesterday, I absolutely would not be able to do it. I couldn't even tell you what I wore yesterday. You know, these exist because often a piece of dialogue has lodged in my brain for very good reason. You know, I have a smaller essay in this book about me deciding that I was going to be a therapist for my fellow fourth graders and sitting on a rock in the corner having, you know, never seen the Peanuts comic strip, and giving advice to them. And the boy I had a crush on came up to me and he said, yeah, I have a problem. And I was so excited to, you know, be his sort of confidant. And he said, yeah, there's this really annoying girl giving advice on a rock. And that is exactly what he said, I can assure you, because I have carried it with me for the rest of the time until today in this interview. So that's quite accurate. But I get a little sort of mad at people who make things up whole cloth. I mean, I will allow, I think I have this sort of quiet, unnamed percentage in my head as a reader when I read David Sedaris. And it vacillates from essay to essay, you know, what seems, but that's not the point of reading him, I think. And I think there's a trust there where, like, he has to trust that, and you can replace me in this scenario, it's just easier to talk about somebody else. He has to trust that a reader knows a little bit of it is fudged or BS or honestly much more innocent than that and probably just hyperbolic. But then they also have to trust that he wouldn't pick up a pen and do this if he was just going to make stuff up. What's the point? So somewhere in there lies the truth. But for me, it's pretty close to the hole, to use a golf analogy I have no right to because I don't play golf. But it's as close as I can make it to the truth.
Yeah, I mean, help me understand that last thing just a little bit. Like, if part of this is about like the fallibility of memory, like how can you know how do you know where the hole is?
Right. I mean, this is what's tricky. You know, what you get with memoir instead of essays is, you know, my story, right? Or my memory is memoir. And with essays, you don't get that. It's allegedly held to more of a sort of standard of truth. These aren't my impressions of, you know, growing up. And you know, it's not the same thing as, you know, Mary Carr or Tobias Wolff, that kind of thing. But what you get in exchange for that standard, though, is the fact that they end. They end all the time, you know. And so 16 times, I think, in this last book, one might say. And so I can only do so much damage to people. You know what I mean? It's like a drive-by.
Yeah.
Of like possibly messing up my memory of that one thing. I'm not going to write Running with Scissors where there's like a family out there somewhere who's so excited to buy this book because, oh, that kid we housed that summer wrote a book. How lovely, you know, and turns out not so lovely.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's not... I lost my train of thought.
Basically, just like,
sorry.
I'll complete your thought. Basically, what I think you're saying is like the form itself lowers the stakes of that particular like minefield.
Yeah, you don't have to. There's no way to lie in a sustained manner in an essay collection.
Yeah.
I mean, you shouldn't do it anyway, but I think it would actually be hard to try. Having said that, I make it sound like I have a much more loosey-goosey attitude than I do. I just know what I come for in other people's writing, and I feel like mine is really close. Also, mine's not, there's not a lot of fact checking that goes on in mine. Mine's, you know, impressions.
Mm-hmm.
So
what do you think people come for?
I have no idea.
Come on.
I will tell you, I did an interview, the Village Voice did an interview with David Sedaris and I. And we sat across from each other and they asked us both the same question. And I went first and they said, what do you think your book's about? And I did this whole song and dance about it. And it's all true, but it's also sort of hard to pin down because there are essays and it's not one grand sweeping theme. You know, it's not like these are essays about music. These are essays about politics. It's not like that. And I tried to answer the question as best as I could. And then they asked David the same question. And he said, I don't think that's for me to say. And I was like, I'm going to kill you. Is that what you get when you get to be David Sedaris? Is I don't think that's for me to say. And it's charming. But it's really, I think what people come for, I always like to say in a sort of non-specific way, like their other Old Man and the Muppet show. You know, they come for that stuck in the middle with you feeling of that if they had been there with me, they would think the same things. And that if I was with them in their sort of most ludicrous moments, I would think the same things or put it well. And there's sort of a comfort in that.
Yeah. That's interesting.
The danger of what I just said, of course, is that like the highest compliment is, oh, it's like hanging out with your best friend. I don't totally want it to be that. I do want to challenge people. I do want people to think slightly differently about, you know, topic X once they leave the essay. But I do ultimately feel like it should be an enjoyable experience.
Yeah, I mean, they're really entertaining.
I mean, I feel, you know, I saw, you know, Jim Crace's?
No.
He's this great British author. He's written like 9 novels. He retired the same time as, I think really the same day as Philip Roth retired, which is a huge freaking mistake. But I saw him speak when he was still in action at the National Arts Club once, and there were a lot of aspiring writers in the audience, and I think they were asking about craft and imagery and all this stuff, and he said this thing that sounded so negative at the time, but I've taken with me as such a practical piece of advice, where he said, you know, never forget that you are a volunteer as a writer, and it is therefore your duty to entertain people, and you can entertain them by making them cry. You can entertain them by challenging them, but you have to entertain people. And, you know, a 4-page description of an oak tree just because you can, not entertaining. And he's like, there is a hierarchy to life. You know, there's a doctor and a carpenter and a chef and a writer, and they're on a desert island. Like, who gets eaten? He didn't say this. This part's me. I get eaten, you know? I mean, and so it wasn't like a huge boon for the arts the way he was talking about, you know, writing and the impetus to create. But that idea is that never forget that you're a volunteer, I think is very important. And I always carry it with me when I write.
It's a nice idea.
Yeah. But the sort of negative image of that is no one needs you, which can be paralyzing if you go too far into it, right?
You don't seem very in touch with like the paralyzing side of that coin, though.
I'm in touch with it based on topic. I mean, if I was too in touch with it, so I'm working on a novel now, and if I was too in touch with thinking, you know, I have quite consciously, both in my fiction and nonfiction, avoided Trump and avoided a lot about the sort of political landscape and the fact that we're all going to die from either carbon emissions or nuclear warfare.
I got to tell you, that was very present for me reading the book.
Really?
Yeah.
What, that we're going to die? Oh, this just took a turn for the worse.
No. How free it was, how absent the very obvious truth that we're all going to die, what was from the kind of like world of the book. It was nice. It's like vacation.
Thanks. Well, thank you. Because, I mean, the thing is, what's weird is like now, because, you know, the more extreme things get in reality, the more extreme escapism has to be. You know, it's like Game of Thrones or bust. But in reality, I think that part of what I'm trying to do with this book or in anything I write is to actually, it is a form of escapism, I guess, because I'm trying to give you permission to be mad about little things.
Yeah.
Like just because there's all this, you know, someone still slid their hand down the subway pole and touched you, you know, or somebody bumped into you, or like there's still these like sort of minor indignities and infractions that occur consistently. And I think there is some sort of robbing if you tell yourself, well, I'm not going to be mad about this because of the political landscape that we're in.
But I feel like in my daily life, like the caveat, like this is a first world problem or like
right.
this is preposterous to complain about, but is like a pretty standard thing.
But it's dangerous. So I have a friend who will remain nameless who published a book of essays a while ago, and she, I think she was a little uneasy with the topic, which was not particularly rarefied. It just wasn't particularly relevant, I guess, or what's deemed socially or Twitter level relevant. And in that way, it was more evergreen, and you could say it was therefore better, but I don't think she did that. And in her writing, she would say, you know it's not Syria, but, or I know this isn't, you know, World War III, but. And I remember reading a draft and taking, you know, not all of them, but a bunch of them out, because I'm like, first of all, no one in their right mind is coming to you for Syria information. You know, it's not. That's their fault. This is ridiculous. I was like, second of all, you're hemming and hawing, and like part of the humor and the impact is to say, you know, that real estate agent is the worst person to have ever lived, right? Everybody is aware that Hitler also happened. Nobody is questioning it. It's part of the style, and it just sort of, I felt like she had been gotten to by the internet, that they had like nibbled at her too much and she was really insecure. And I'm not, you know, impervious to it, especially when it comes to the narrative nonfiction. But with fiction, I'm like kind of impervious to the world around me a little bit, which makes it sound like there's not going to be any connective tissue when people read it. It's not very selling, but it's more that I just don't feel like I have to respond to this exact moment.
How do you feel like it nibbles in the nonfiction and not in the fiction? Like how does that manifest in nonfiction?
I just feel like I know it, you know, I'm a person who reads their reviews. And I can feel myself as a white urban woman, Jewish, but who really cares? You know, I can feel that. And I think that the idea of like, poor me, woe is the little white urban girl in her West Village apartment, I think I have to be extremely careful with that. And not just because of other people's reactions, but because of how I operate in the world. I'm not a jerk. You know what I mean? I know my experience has its limits, and that other people's experiences should also have room to breathe. And therefore, I feel like the standard for me to write certain kinds of nonfiction, it's actually a quite healthy thing, is even higher. So like my favorite essay from this past book is the one about my rich teenage neighbors.
Yeah.
But of course, I have to live in the nice neighborhood, you know, with all the tree-lined streets in order to see them. But that's why it was all the more important that I make about something bigger than them. And that's why I like that essay. And I don't know if I would have been as conscious about it like 8 years ago.
Okay, I think that makes sense to me. I feel like I should ask you very quickly about magazine writing.
Okay, yeah.
Before we go.
Okay.
I just read a bunch of pieces today, right before you got here. Like you just went and hung out with Dr. Ruth.
I did.
And Stormy Daniels.
Yes. The last three women specifically I interviewed, because there's been men, but... or Laura Dern,
yeah.
Stormy Daniels, and Dr. Ruth. And once things come in threes, you either have like a style section article or a funny joke, right? Like a duck, a priest, and a nun walk into a bar, and like I can't help but picture all three of these women in the same room together.
How does that magazine work fit into your life? Like, A, how do you think about it in relationship to the other stuff you're doing? And B, do you feel like you sort of from a career or financial or other standpoint need to do it, or do you want to?
I mean, we'll start with the easiest. Like, it is nice to get a little check every once in a while in between books, as opposed to having to, you know, store up, you know, your advance in your cheeks like it's all the money you're ever gonna get.
Yeah.
And run up a tree with it, you know. There is something nice to, and so I would say that the hit of the byline as well as the little bank account hit are sort of intertwined. It's also nice to have that outside constraint of trying to fit your voice without having your voice take away from the voice of the person you're profiling ever. Like, I think 90% of the time it's a good idea to have the other person speak as the kicker. You know, it's very rare that you should just say, you know, and then I walked out thinking my thoughts about that person, you know? And so it's nice to sort of actually give up that prism for a while, which is so present in my nonfiction mm-hmm. and give it to somebody else. But then also to try to make it seem like I wrote it, you know, with some sort of personality and going back and forth with editors about what stays and what goes. It's reminiscent of a day job and having that human connection. So it's not just the person I'm profiling that becomes interesting, but it becomes in the editing. That process becomes very interesting to me and very sort of, I think it's just a connection with the outside world a little bit, and it keeps you curious because, you know, when you work from home, it can be quite insular. And, you know, I used to get very annoyed when I had two careers at once and, you know, I thought, oh God, I have to send in this W-9 form. I have to do all this stuff for this, you know, magazine while I'm also working with all these authors and I'm also, you know, burning the candle at both ends and staying, you know, at the office so late. And it used to be sort of annoying to me. And now I'm like, I'll go back and forth with an editor forever. I was like, what do you want me to do? It's great.
All right. Here's my last question, which is like, we started talking about like this job you had and when it felt like this might be very far away. And then this moment where you like pull your book from HarperCollins and all these things. My question, I think, is basically like, do you feel like set now? Are you good?
Can I answer a long way and a short way?
Yeah.
I had a friend who was on the subway the other day and it got stuck. And she was two guys on the subway, and one of the guys was sort of a homeless guy, but he had a satchel with him of, I guess, black spray paint. And he took it out, started shaking it, which is already tough in close quarters in the subway, and they're trapped. And he was bald, and he spray painted his entire skull black, like dripping with paint, heinously smelly. And then he also started taking his back like a bear against a tree, against the subway pole, which is not very effective, but scratching up and down and moving his spine up and down the subway pole. The subway doors open, everyone floods out, and, you know, she's trying to avoid him, but somehow, you know, they sort of meet up on the stairs with just sort of the partition of the railing in between them, and they make eye contact, and he looks at her and he goes, "You good?" And she was like, "Yeah, I guess so." That's the end of the story. Anyway, sorry, just you said "you good," and it's all I can think about.
Is that person you?
No.
Did you just fictionalize that story?
No. In fact, the impulse to make it my own is overwhelming, and it is not.
I'm just saying there's a lot of specificity in that story.
I mean, I remembered every detail of it, obviously. I have a good memory. But no, do I feel secure in my career and like I'm officially this sort of thing that I've created, I guess?
Yeah.
Almost never. Almost never. On book tour, I do, just because of how people respond to you, and you can't help but feel that, and it's really lovely, and people come out and they tell you exactly what your work has meant to them, and it's really hard to take that level of sincerity to my face. It's really hard to know how to respond. I usually end up apologizing for smiling. You know, I say, "I'm sorry, I'm smiling. I'm just really moved and I don't know how to react." You know, I almost have to like issue a disclaimer. And it's wonderful. I mean, book tour is also bizarre and lonely making, but it's really great. And then I think, you know, I try to make a note to self to carry that with me when I go a little bit, but it usually doesn't work. But I think it's healthy for it not to work. You know, I think I have enough of knowing that somebody is going to read my next book, that my insecurity is more someone's going to read it and what if it sucks? Not no one's going to read it. So it's just a different brand of insecurity.
Hey, Sloan, thanks for doing this.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. It's great.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Janelle Piper, and our new intern, is Louisa Garbowit. Welcome, Louisa. Our sponsors this week, MailChimp, Pit Writers, Squarespace, and The Great Courses. Thanks to all of them for making it possible for us to make this show. And thanks most of all to Sloan Crosley. Her new collection is called Look Alive Out There. I recommend it. We'll see you next week.